Good evening, everybody. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
My sobriety date is November 22nd, 2006. I have a sponsor. I often like to say he's the best sponsor in the world because I just never know when he's going to show up. So, and I have the honor of sponsoring guys. AA has been, I can't say it enough words what AA has meant to me. It has saved my life. It has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I want to thank Billy for asking me to come up here. I want to thank Bob and Kelly, Bob, for offering to come and be our guide, and Kelly to provide the nice wheels for us to get here. It was great there having their company and coming through this beautiful country that you've got here. It's an honor for me to be here. It really is. I mean, I hear that a lot from the podium. But for me, it is exceptionally special because not too many years ago, there wasn't too many people that wanted me anywhere. And if they happened to make the mistake of having me present, they didn't make that mistake again. And they tried everything to avoid being wherever I was. My job here tonight is to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And with God's help, I'm going to do that with the best of my ability. I had a fairly normal upbringing. I hear a lot of speakers talk about from the podium how they didn't feel right in their skin, that they didn't feel like they fit or belong, and really that was not my experience. I related a whole lot more to Bill W. when he talked about how he felt like he had arrived. Because really, growing up, I felt very comfortable in my own skin. I felt like, if anything, I was it. In fact, my particular problem really was not enough, not necessarily not fitting. My biggest problem was that I just wasn't getting enough out of life. And I don't say things like this to try to represent myself as being better than anybody else, but one of the things that I had a problem with in the first 15 months in this program was comparing myself out to folks. I looked very carefully and I listened very carefully to everybody in these rooms, and I seized upon anything that was different, trying to prove that I was not an alcoholic. That was my mission for the first 15 months. So as I draw some comparisons about some of the common things that I've heard, it's only because I spent a lot of time comparing myself out. I spent a lot of time pointing to things and thinking that I'm not an alcoholic because of those particular things. And I might as well throw out, I never had a DUI. I never spent a day in jail because of my drinking. Well, I never spent a day in jail, period. I never lost a job. I'm in the same job now that I've been for nearly 30 years. And I never lost a home or a marriage or anything like that. And again, it's not because I'm better than anybody else. Lord knows I gave it my best in terms of being out there trying to get picked up for drunken while driving. I did my fair share. I don't know where the law enforcement officers were, but I was a danger to a lot of you folks, not to mention myself, on many, many, many occasions. But I point these things out because if there's anybody out there that has the problems that I had, where I was looking for things that didn't apply, that was a big problem for me early on. Now, when I grew up, I had a very normal upbringing. I had two loving parents who stayed married until they were separated by death. And they wanted the best for me. I wanted the best for me, too. I wanted a little bit more than what they wanted. But anyway, they always gave me exactly what I need. It may not have always been exactly what I wanted, but they raised me, they taught me well, and they gave me everything I needed in life. And you would think if that all took hold that I could sit down right now and maybe you would listen to somebody else, but that's not exactly what happened to me. I don't know exactly when I took my first drink. I grew up in a household where it was customary to give the child a sip out of mom and dad's wine or a sip out of their beer. So I don't really remember exactly when I had my first drink, but I do remember vividly my first drunk. My dad was career military. He was a deputy base commander. With that came social responsibilities, entertaining a lot, and so he always had a well-stocked bar. And I had a group of friends like any other kid growing up that we were special, something about us that was special against everybody else in the world. And we had made these plans. We had this fort out in the woods that we always used to spend a lot of time at. And we made these plans this one particular weekend that we were all supposed to bring something special for that. And I don't know what the reason was. It was, but we all, everybody was supposed to bring something special, something different, something that we didn't normally have. And since my dad had a well-stocked bar, I snuck downstairs before leaving that morning for the fort, and I took an old grape knee-high bottle. And back in those days, they were made out of glass, and a 16-ounce grape knee-high bottle, and filled it with bourbon. I put one of those old Ronco rubber stoppers into it, you know. And I took off out of the house and found my way to the fort up in the woods. And pulled that out with my friends, and I uncorked that, and I took a big hit off that. And, well, you can just imagine what a big hit of bourbon did to a 13-year-old kid for the first time. But I did everything I could to keep that down. I mean, it did not come back up. I've heard a lot of speakers talk about how it jumped right back out. It didn't. I forced it to stay down. I gutted it out. Because I'm not a wimp, you know. I'm going to take it like a man. And I passed it on, and everybody who took that first hit had the same experience. You could see them going like this and doing everything they could to hold it down. And I came back around, and I took another big pull off of it, and I handed it to the next guy. And everybody else, when they got it the second time around, you know, they kind of did this and passed it on real quick. And so I ended up pretty much drinking the rest of that bottle by myself. Have no clue to this day how I got home. And that, it was kind of funny because early on in sobriety, I heard about blackout drinkers, and I thought I never had those experiences. But in time, I can look back at situations like that. Obviously, it was a blackout situation because I made it home safely, but I have no idea how I got there. I do remember waking up on my parents' sofa down in the basement. I do remember being as sick as I could possibly be. And I do remember vividly not the experience that a lot of people said that they couldn't wait to do that all over again. That was not my experience. I couldn't wait not to ever do that again. Yet, in the end, and even to this day, I suppose, my drink of choice is straight bourbon. And the interesting thing is that, you know, there's been a number of things in my life that I've experienced that have made me deathly ill. Certain foods that have made me so sick. And to this day, I've never put those particular food in my mouth. There's a ride that I went on when I was a teenager. And you got in it. It was a circular room. And you got against the wall, and it just started spinning like crazy, and the floor dropped out, and you were stuck against the wall. That messed up my equilibrium like nobody's business. And to this day, I will not go on anything that goes in circles. To this day, there are certain foods I will not eat. But I had no problem finding my way back to bourbon. Now, I didn't really have, I had a very normal upbringing. I was blessed with academic abilities. I was blessed with athletic abilities. And so I had a fairly normal childhood upbringing. I didn't go looking to drink every chance I could. I didn't pass it up. But one thing I do remember in looking back is that whenever I ever had the opportunity to drink, it was never just one or two. It was always all I could get. And it was either until I passed out or until it was gone on every single occasion. But my upbringing, I had no serious consequences of any time. I was very fortunate. I was blessed. I went through college. I came out of college. went into graduate school, finished that, came out, got married, and life was good. Again, every now and then, whenever I did drink, it was always to excess. It was never just one or two. When I came out of college and got married, I watched my father-in-law, who was a corporate captain in corporate industry, and part of his daily routine was to come home and have a cocktail or two. So to me, that was part of normal fare. I'd come home every day and have a cocktail or two or three or four, half a bottle, whatever, sometimes more than half a bottle. But it was always, you know, until I couldn't drink anymore, usually. Now, the big book talks about having to find a power greater than ourselves in order to overcome drinking. And back then, the power that I found was the desire to climb the corporate ladder. I saw that drinking was getting in my way, and I wanted to make it big in this world. And, I mean, there's a story just like me in the big book about the guy that put the booze away and vowed never to come back to it until he retired. And that I related to that guy because that's exactly what happened to me. I went for a period of 15 years. I didn't take a drink. Now, I was anything but sober during that period of time because I was in it for me. Everything, the life was in it for me. Remember I said earlier on that my problem in life was not enough. And if that meant stepping on you, if that meant hurting you, if you got in my way, then that was your problem. Now, as I pointed out, you know, there was a period of time where people simply didn't want to be around me. And I really didn't care, because if you didn't give me what I needed to get, then, you know, you were in my way. And if you got hurt, that was your fault. Well, at some point in time, and I don't know exactly when, but I returned to drinking, first on a social setting. And I would only drink at parties, maybe if my wife and I went out to dinner or something like that, a few drinks here or there. It was never out of control. I don't know exactly when I crossed the line, when it became out of control, but there are certain things that I do recall now that jump out vividly in my mind. My wife came home from work one day, and out in our garage, off of our garage is a workshop, my workshop, and she went out there looking for something, and she came walking in, and she had a half a bottle of Wild Turkey. And she says, "What's this bottle of Wild Turkey doing out in your work shed?" And I said, "I don't know, but thanks. I've been looking for that everywhere." Now, she didn't think it was amusing. And the fact that you can just imagine the look on her face. And my thought was, this isn't good. And the first thing that occurs to me is that this was before anybody had started, you know, suggesting I had a problem with drinking. Anybody was questioning my drinking. Yet instinctively at that point, I was hiding booze. To this day, I don't know how that bottle got there. But the other thing I thought of was that the look on her face was not good, and I had to do something about that. So I went to smaller bottles. I went to pints. And that worked for a while, until one day she came home and said, "What's that half-filled pint of bourbon doing on the bumper of your truck?" Now, when you corner me or scare me, you know, I'm going to lie. And the best I could come up with was, "I don't know." I mean, the only ones in the house at that point in time are her, me, the two dogs, and the cat. So, but I don't know is the best I could come up with. She kind of shook her head and walked away at that point. And again, I thought, okay, I've got to do something about that. So I went smaller. I went to mini bottles. And mini bottles are great because I drive a pickup truck and I've got a console and I could fill the console with mini bottles. I could down one of those, throw it out the window, the evidence is gone. I'm never going to get caught again with another half drunk bottle of bourbon sitting around. Well, that didn't exactly play out that way. There were many a times where she came out and came home and I was passed out with a dozen mini bottles sitting on the table beside me. But I still don't have a problem. In fact, when she started suggesting that I had maybe a problem with drinking, I pointed to the 15 years that I didn't drink as an example of, no, I don't have a problem with drinking. I can quit drinking anytime I want. I proved it once before. I can do it again if I want to. I just don't want to. Well, I'd like to say, and I mentioned earlier, that there was no really serious consequences with my drinking, and that's not exactly true. I was kind of alluding earlier to Ursula. We were sharing and exchanging, comparing stories with kids. There was a time, and it was close to an election year. It was during the fall. And my son, he was about 25 years old, and he was over at the house visiting. And we were standing out in my garage. And one of the things that my son and I love to do is debate politics. And we're usually on opposite ends of the spectrum. But that's okay. And we love to debate with each other. My daughter and my wife don't like listening to the debate, so we usually take it out into the garage or outside where they don't have to listen to it. And we're standing out there tackling the issues of the day. He's sipping on a Coke. I'm tossing down mini bottles. And there was a point in the debate where I had cornered him with a logical question that he couldn't escape. And out of frustration, he swung his hands down like that and said like something like crap or I don't know. And I don't know what it was, but that action on his part set me off. I don't know to this day why. But I grabbed him by the shirt, I shoved him across the garage, and slammed him into the garage wall. And he's standing there in fear of his life. I didn't know that at the moment. I found out later that he was actually in fear of his life at that moment. And what he was looking at was not his dad. And what he was saying was, "Dad, Dad, it's me. It's me, Dad. And I'm not responding. I'm full of rage. I'm in absolute rage, and all I want to do is choke him. I have no idea. And I don't know why, and I don't know why it happened just as easily as it came on me, but the rage went away, and I dropped my hands, and I told him to get the F out. And he bowed his head, and he dusted himself off, and he picked up his papers, and he slumped, and he walked with his stoop head away, and he got in his car, and he drove off. And I didn't see or hear from him for 15 to 16 months. He wouldn't take my phone calls. He wouldn't answer my emails. He didn't want anything to do with me. And I don't blame him. During that time, my daughter was 23. Now, she wasn't dodging my phone calls, but she really wasn't coming around either. In fact, one of the things I found out, another thing later, was that she was asking my wife, "Why are you staying with him?" My wife, current wife at the time, was not her mother. They were close friends. And she said, "He's my dad and I love him, but why are you staying with him? He treats you like dirt." And I guess my wife had thought about that for a while, because all of a sudden she started telling me that I was going to have to do something about my drinking, because she couldn't take it anymore. Well, the environment that I work in, I have a lot of people that whine, are whining all the time about this, that, and the other. And I discovered a very effective technique years ago, is that when somebody comes to whine to you about a problem, you throw it back into them, for them to come up with a solution. And usually, that quiets them right down. So I pulled that little tool out of my box and threw it back to my wife, and I said, "Well, what do you suggest?" And she says, "How about AA?" "No, I don't think so. I can't do AA." Now, I don't know what AA is, but I can't do it. I'm pretty sure it involves a group hug, and I don't do group hugs. I don't do group anything, see. By this point in my drinking, the only thing I want to do is come home, sit on my back deck with my two dogs by my side, because they love me no matter what. And they don't complain about my drinking. They don't complain about anything. They're just glad to be there because, you know, I'm going to feed them. And that's all I want to do. So go to some place that got to be around people. They're going to want a hug. I'm sure of it, you know. I don't know what AA is, but this is not what I'm going to do. And I tell her I'm not going to do this. She says, well, you're going to have to do something. Not a problem. I'll take care of it. She wants to know what I'm going to do to take care of it. And I tell her, well, you know, when I went through the divorce many years ago, it was a very hard time, and I had a counselor that helped me through it. I will call him and ask him for some help. And I called him, and I told him that I might have a little bit of a problem with drinking, just a little bit. Does he have anybody that could work with me, maybe to help me just get a jump start on this thing? I just need to get 30 days under my belt or so. I'm having a little trouble getting. If I can just get that going, I'll be good. So he gives me the name of a therapist. And I go, and I meet with this fellow. And I go once a week. And the first time I go to him, I sit down and I talk with him. And I tell him my woes and my troubles. And I said, what do you think? He says, have you considered AA? No, I don't think it's that bad. I'm going to pay you. You're going to help me, right? And he says, well, yeah, but I think that you might want to consider AA. I'll be happy to help you, but you might want to consider AA. I don't think it's that bad yet. So I started going to see him. And it works, you know. Go a week, no drinking. 2 weeks, no drinking. Before I know it, it's a month, and I'm not drinking. See, because now I'm figuring out what it is that you people are doing to irritate me, to make me drink. Because he's helping me unfold all of these problems in my head. This is all I needed. I just needed a little help to figure out how not to drink, you know, all the time. And then I start thinking I'm making a little bit too much of this thing. And I start realizing, you know what, I can just drink on weekends and I'll be good. So I start drinking on weekends, on Saturdays and Sundays. And it occurs to me that Friday's part of the weekend. This is football season. Monday night football is part of the weekend. Yeah, I can see, you know where this is going. Before you know, I'm drinking every day again. But, you know, part of the reason I went to mini bottles, too, was because it's a way for me to control the drinking. You know, that was an interesting experience all by itself. But so I'm still going to this guy, and I'm still paying him money, and I'm telling him I'm not drinking. And in my mind, I'm not. I'm not drinking when I'm during the week, you know. So everything's good. Then it gets to be the point where, you know, this is. I'm just making too much of this. I just need to cut it off at a couple of drinks a day. And it occurs to me that I can, on the way to my session one night for him, that I'm going to stop at the ABC store and pick up 2 or 3 mini bottles to have waiting for me when I come out from my session with him. So I do that for a while, and that works too. Then it occurs to me that maybe 1 or 2 bottles will take the edge off before I go into the session and still have 3 or 4 waiting when I come out, to really help make the evening good. Yeah. And I think I'm hiding this all the while. I think I'm fooling my wife. Until one day we're on our way out to work, and she just comes to me in a very loving and kind way, and it's the morning, and she says, do you have to rush out right away, or do you have a second? And I said, no, I got a minute. What are you doing? She says, well, I need to talk to you about something. And I said, okay. And so we go in and sit down. And I said, what's up? And she looks at me and she says, Tom, I love you with all my heart. I want to grow old with you. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. But you're killing yourself. And I can't sit here and watch this anymore. And this weekend, you and I are going to settle up. And I'm leaving. She had already picked out the house. She was ready to go. The first thought in my head was, good, now I can drink in peace. The second thought in my head is absolute rage. How dare she? So I don't say anything. I just tell her, well, if that's really what you decide you need, that's fine. I got to go. So I get in my truck and I head to work. And the committee's going. And I'm just, you know, in rage. And I didn't know it at the time, but I came to understand it later, but that was the first time God talked to me. Because the next thought was in my head was, you can't do this. You can't lose this woman. You've lost your son. Your daughter's not coming around. You don't have any friends. You can't lose this woman. And the reason why I know that was God talking to me is because I'm the type of guy who'll cut off his nose despite his face. I will do that. I'm that stubborn. And I get to work, and I send her an email, and I tell her that I will support whatever she needs to do. I will help her make it easy. But I've decided I'm going to escalate this, and I'm going to kick it up a notch or two. So I call the psychiatrist that I'm seeing, and I tell him this thing isn't working, and that maybe we need to call my doctor and get some drugs involved or something. I don't know, but just these sessions aren't all by themselves working. We need to do something else. And again, he suggests that I consider AA. And again, I tell him it's not that bad. And again, I have no idea what AA is. But it certainly can't be that bad. And he said, well, I'm going to send you to a fellow by the name of Sherman Masters. Sherman Masters, I said, who's that? He said, well, he happens to be one of the foremost experts in substance and alcohol abuse in the Richmond area. You go see him. He's a great counselor. So I make an appointment with him. I go sit in with him. I tell him all my woes and troubles and everything else. And I say, what do you think? He says, have you been to AA? Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but now I'm starting to think that my wife has called ahead to all of these people. Because how could all these people be coming up with the same suggestion? I mean, this is not, you know, it's too much of a coincidence. And I tell him the same thing. I don't think it's that bad. What else have you got? He says, would you consider checking in for a 30-day inpatient treatment program? I said, no, I can't do that because I have a job. I've got people dependent on me. I can't disappear for 30 days. What else have you got? And he suggests an IOP. And what's that? It's an intensive outpatient program. He says you go 3 times a week. It's 3 hours a night. It's after work. You don't have to miss any work. I can do that. So I make an appointment with an IOP that he gives me the name and number. And I go sit and I take this. And by this time, I really am toast. I'm out of answers. I've tried everything that I can possibly try to help control my drinking. And I just can't seem to get these 30 days under my belt that I need in order to get a jump start. I need help. So I meet with this woman, and I answer all of her questions as honestly as I possibly can. And after 2.5 hours of meeting, she tells me, she says, well, Tom, if you haven't figured it out, I'll tell you right now, you're an alcoholic. And I said, okay, so what do you suggest? She says, well, we can take you. We'll take you, and we'll help you. But you have to agree to certain things. And I said, okay. Such as? She says, well, you have to agree to come 3 times a week. I think it was Monday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. I said, okay. She says, you have to agree to stay for the full 3 hours. Okay. You agree to show up on time. Okay. You agree to stay throughout the whole session. Okay. You agree to respect other people. Okay. You agree to go to 3 AA meetings a week. Okay, what? You agree to go to 3 AA meetings a week. Now, I don't think I need to do that. I'm paying you money. You're going to help me. I didn't realize at the time, but she was an 18-year member, sober member of AA. And she looked at me and she said, Tom, you are what we describe as an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. And we're going to help you some here, but your only hope and chance in this world to stay sober is AA. And I said, well, I just don't think I can do that. She says, we won't take you. I said, but I'm going to pay you money. She says, I don't care. I'm not in this for the money. I'm in this to help people. And if you don't agree to this, we won't take you. So now I'm about ready to flunk out of IOP, and I haven't even been to my first session. Okay. I agree to do this. I go home. My wife asks me how it goes. And I tell her, I hope she's happy. I have to go to AA now. I go to my first session, and it's a Thursday night, and I go up to the counselor afterwards, and I said, look, evidently I have to go to 3 AA meetings a week, right? And he said, yes. He says, I said, well, I have no idea where to go. Can you help me find some meetings to go to? He says, sure. Where do you live? I tell him. He says, oh. He says, this is great. I've got a perfect meeting for you. It's a Friday night meeting, and its name is Jaywalkers. They've changed the format some, but back then, Friday night Jaywalkers was, he says, 7 o'clock is a beginner's meeting, which is great for you. And they go for about 40 minutes, and then they take a break, and they come back for a closed meeting. And the second, you know, it is, goes from 8 to 9. And I'm thinking, cool. 2 meetings in one night. I said, okay, so I get 2 meetings out of the way, just like that. He says, no, you get 1. But you said that there were 2 separate meetings. He says, that's right. I said, so I get credit for 2 meetings. No, you get credit for 1. I said, well, what happens if I go to the 7 o'clock meeting but not the 8 o'clock meeting? How many credits do I get? He says, 1. I said, what happens if I go to the 8 o'clock meeting but not the 7 o'clock meeting? How many credits do I get? He says, 1. What if I go to the 7 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting? How many credits do I get? He says, 1. And I'm thinking, does this guy think I'm stupid or what? And I'm thinking, I'll go to the 7 o'clock meeting. It's the shortest one. I'm not giving up my Friday night and only getting, and for 2 meetings and only getting 1. This guy, and I'm talking to myself all the way out the door, you know. And I go to the 7 o'clock meeting. I pull up. I sit outside and I watch you people. You're standing outside talking. Nobody's going inside. Why aren't you going inside? I don't want you to see me arriving, so you know, I wait until everybody disappears and go inside, and then I sleep in. And I come in the back, and I find a seat as far in the back as I can. Actually, that's not exactly true. I found the seat close to, you know, next to the prettiest girl in the room, and I'm talking to her the whole time. Well, anyway, I go home. My wife says, well, how was it? I said, Sharon, I just can't believe it. There's just so much talk of God. The only thing that was missing was the salvation bell ringer out front. I just don't know if I can deal with this. Well, she knows how to push my buttons, and she says, Tom, I can't believe somebody as smart as you can't find a way to make this work. Well, she knows what to say and how to challenge me. Unfortunately, that happened to be a good thing, bad thing, because later on, my next session at the IOP, they informed me I had to have a sponsor. I didn't know what a sponsor was, but I knew I didn't want one. I was at the meeting at Jaywalkers, and back then, that first meeting, when the beginner's meeting ended, the way they used to do it back then was that they went around the room, and every person identified themselves, their sobriety date, if they had a sponsor, and when they spoke to their sponsor last. And one of the things I noticed was every person who didn't have a sponsor, everybody turned around and looked at them. Man, I didn't want you looking at me. So when it came to my turn, I said I had a sponsor. I don't even know what a sponsor is, but I do know I don't want one. And I told the counselor, I don't need a sponsor. I'm smart enough to understand this book and to figure this out. All I need is the book. And they said, well, you have to have a sponsor. Why do I have to have a sponsor? You agreed to it. No. We went through the dialogue. There wasn't anything about a sponsor. Well, you signed this paper. What else did I sign? all right, I got to get a sponsor. So when I found a guy, I asked him to be my sponsor, and he asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths. I remember what my wife said. I said, yes, but I'm going to have to do this in a way that makes sense to me. You know, I've read this book a whole lot since then. And it talks about this is a suggested program of recovery. But I'm pretty sure there's nowhere in there that it says in a way that makes sense to me. But that's the way I approach this. You know, part of it was I went home that first night after Jaywalkers because the cute girl told me that I ought to get the book and read the first 164 pages, so I did that. And that turned out to be a problem, too. You know, I knew where all this was going. And, you know, that nine-step amends thing wasn't going to happen. I'm not telling anybody I was wrong. I spent a whole lifetime being right. I spent a whole lifetime being right and proving I was right. There was no way I was telling anybody I was wrong. But I told the guy, yeah, I'd do whatever I could, whatever I could. So we started out, he started taking me through the big book. The other problem I found out with the big book was that it was written way long time ago. I mean, for God's sakes, why don't you update this thing? I mean, they're talking about, there's a section in here where they're talking about people saying, I bet that they'll make it to the moon. Come on, folks. You know? This book is out of date. I'm going to... See, it's for people that aren't very smart. But I'll find a way to make this work my own. So when we're going through the big book, and my sponsor, we get to the point where he tells me, after we've gone through the chapter on we agnostics, and he... asked me, am I willing to believe? I tell him, Stephen, I told you right from the get-go that I had a problem with God. And he looks at me and says, Tom, you're going to have to find a power greater than yourself. He says, I'm not going to tell you what that power is, but you're going to have to find a power greater than yourself, or this isn't going to work. And we were out on my deck, and he left me. He said, I want you to sit out here, and I want you to think about that. And I want you to work on trying to find a power greater than yourself. So he left. And I sat there, and I looked around. I looked up, saw the wind blowing the leaves through the trees. There's a power greater than me. I can't do anything to stop that wind from blowing those trees. There is a power greater than myself, and proclaim myself spiritually fit. I was drunk in a week. See, I did all the things that I wanted to do, all the things that made sense to me. You know, I'm going to do it my way. And part of it was I really liked the saying, you know, just don't drink, go to meetings. That was one I could do. Just don't drink and go to meetings. But it's a death sentence for somebody like me, because just don't drink and go to meetings will work, and doing nothing else will work for a period of time until just don't drink and go to meetings turns into just don't drink and go to meetings and drink after the meetings. Because that's what eventually happened. And after the first 3 months of sobriety, I don't know when I started drinking. I know I made it three honest months. Did I make it four? I can't remember. But I certainly started drinking before five. And I'm still thinking I've got this thing licked. Because what I'm doing is I'm only stopping and I'm starting on the way home and I'm just stopping to get two or three, you know, mini bottles. Because that's all I need. And unfortunately, I get out to my truck, and I down one real quick, and out that goes. And by the time I get home, and the ABC store is only a mile and a half from my house, two of the mini bottles are gone. Now I got one that I got to savor. until my wife gets home. And then I start savoring it, and then she calls and lets me know that she's running a little bit late. And I'm thinking, good, now I can go get another couple of bottles. I got time. I can't go back to the same ABC store, because Lord knows I don't want them to think I was just there. I can't go back in there and let them think I'm a drunk. So I go to a different ABC store, and I come back. And I still have time, because those two or three bottles are gone. So I go to that keeps up like that. So my wife, she finally corners me and accuses me of drinking, and I tell her I'm not. And she says, Tom, if tomorrow was your 5th month anniversary, could you pick up a 5-month chip? Yes. See, in my mind, I'm telling the truth, because they've got 30-day chips, they got 3-month chips, they got 6-month, they don't have 5-month chips, so yeah, I could. To me, that all made sense. Well, things continue like that. I finally come clean. I pick up another white chip. I get back into the program a little bit. I do a little bit more. I go for a couple more months. And it just keeps repeating itself. And it talks about in the book, you know, that after each period of sobriety, just gets worse and worse. And that's what starts happening to me. It just keeps getting worse. And gets to the point where I just say, screw it, and I'm just drinking. And I'm picking up chips. I actually picked up a 9-month chip. November 21st, 2006, rolls around. It was a Tuesday before Thanksgiving. My wife's parents live in Columbia, South Carolina, and we're going to go to her parents' house for Thanksgiving. But because of our work schedules, we're going to have to drive separately, which is wonderful because I can drink all the way down. And so I leave, and I'm thinking about this. I'm planning this. I'm savoring this. And I leave work at half day on Tuesday, because I got errands to run to get ready. And I stop at the ABC store on the way home, and I pick up a 12-pack of mini bottles of Wild Turkey, and I empty them into my console. I'm not drinking those. This is for the trip tomorrow. And I go home, and I've got two dogs, and I want to give them a bath before we go to her in-laws. I mean, to get her to my in-laws, her parents. And there's a place near where I live. It's called Critter Town, and it's kind of like a do-it-yourself car wash, but for dogs. So you've got the tubs and the shampoo and the blowers and everything. You just bring your dog in there, and you pay them a fee, and you get to use their facility. And it's great. It really is great. And so I get the first dog, and I'm heading up there, and I'm thinking, you know, one little mini bottle will just take the edge. We'll make it easier to get through these baths for these dogs. I've got Sheltie, so they're long. It's not just an in-and-out thing. It's a production to bathe them and get them dry. So a mini bottle will take the edge off, help me get through this a little easier. Well, this place is only a mile and a half, 2 miles from my house. By the time I get up there, that one is 2 mini bottles. And I get that first dog clean, and I get him home. I pick up the other dog. First dog got 2 bottles. Second dog deserves 2 bottles. Well, by the time I finished the second dog, got him home, all 12 were gone. I don't know how that happened, but all 12 were gone. Now I'm in trouble because I got tomorrow's trip and I got no booze. So I stop at another ABC store and I pick up another 12-pack. And I still have errands to run. I got to go see my dad. I got to, you know. And as I'm running through those errands, the second 12-pack is gone. So I stop and buy another one, third 12-pack. And that one is gone, and I get the fourth one. I'm pretty much toast at this point. And I'm at my house, and I'm stumbling and bumbling and falling and everything. My wife comes in, and she says, "You're drunk." And I said, "Yeah, but it's okay. I figure it out. I'm not an alcoholic." And she just starts crying. I said, no, you don't understand. You don't go to these meetings. You don't listen to what these people do. I haven't done all these things that these people do. Well, she's crying like I've never seen her before, because I've just ripped every last bit of hope Because as long as I was saying I'm an alcoholic, as long as I'm going to meetings, as long as I'm trying, there was hope. I just told her I'm not an alcoholic. I don't want to hear her cry. She doesn't want to be around me. I go to one of the front bed guest bedrooms. I close the door. I slump down. And it's the first time that the thought comes to me. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. So what? And that was key, and it was so important to me because, you know, the reality is I can sit here and I can stick out my hand. I can say, hi, I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. I can tell you that all I want. It doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't mean a thing until I say it to myself. The book talks about it. We have to admit to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. And that was the moment of truth for me. And I slumped on the floor, and I admitted I was an alcoholic. And I said, so what? I can't do this anymore. I can't get up and pick up another white chip. I can't go through this anymore. I'll end up dying. So what? And I sat there for about 5 minutes in my own self-pity. And this is the second time that God talked to me. And the reason why I know that, because the thought came to my head, yes, you will. You'll get yourself up, you'll dust yourself off, and you'll pick up a white chip and you'll move forward. And I did. And I knew right then and there I was done. I haven't had a thought or desire for a drink since that time. I told my sponsor, I'll do whatever you tell me. You know, I kind of rambled on a little bit. There's so much of sobriety that has just been so important to me. When I got to do my amends, you know, one of the things Kelly talks about, and I like to listen to him, is the importance of making amends to parents and how important that was. And that bothered me because my mom died before I got to be sober. And my dad had severe dementia and he didn't even know who I was. And I talked to my dad and I talked to my sponsor when it came to going through my amends, and I talked to him at great length about this, especially with my mom, how much it bothered me because I never had a chance to make amends to her. And he told me that there's a lot of ways that we could do this. He says a lot of people will write a letter, they'll go read it at the gravesite, and he said those are all things that you can do if you want. He said, but the main thing to do is be open for opportunities to be helpful. And he says, you'll know them when they come. The next day, I have to go to D.C., Washington, on business, and I get on the train to take a train to D.C., and the train's just about empty. I'm in the business car, and it's about empty. There's maybe three or four people in there, and I'm sitting there with my papers and everything because I got meetings to get ready for, and I hear this voice, and I look up, and there's a little old lady, about 80 years old, about the age my mom was when my mom died. And she says, do you mind if I sit next to you? And my first thought was, this train is empty, you know. But I remember what my sponsor said, you know, look for opportunities to be useful. Look for opportunities to be helpful. And I said, of course, please sit down. And she sits down. And I ask her, okay, you know, she doesn't say anything. I think, okay, Alex, I hear you, you know. It's going in my mind. So I ask her what, you know, where she's going. She's heading back home to New York. And she was there to visit her daughter and her grandchildren. And those 2 hours goes by, and all she does is telling me about her grandchildren and her daughter and her son-in-law and her trip and everything else. And there was just magic in her eyes the whole time because somebody was sitting there listening. And the odd thing was, is I really wanted to listen to what she had to say, which is not me. And that was an experience that I will treasure for the rest of my life. And I don't get there without this program. I don't get to that point in my life without good sponsorship, without having taken the steps, without having a home group and the responsibility within that home group, without having a job, without getting in the center of this thing that has saved my life. My son, who didn't want anything to do with me, we have a marvelous relationship. When everything, something important, exciting happens in his life, the first thing he does, he picks up the phone and calls me to tell me about it. My daughter, who wasn't coming around, I got to march her down the aisle to be married last April, a year ago this month. I got to be present for that. More importantly, she would call me and talk to me about the arrangements for the wedding, you know, in the months leading up to it. And a week before the wedding started, before the wedding, she called me in tears because the pressure was building up and it was just, everything was crashing down on her, the job, the wedding, the arrangements, this, that, and the other, and everything. And we sat on the phone for about an hour and just talked. And by the time we got through it, and by the time the conversation ended, she was laughing. And she said, "Thanks, Dad. You always know what to say." I didn't say anything. I listened because you people told me and taught me that sometimes it's just more important to listen than to talk. I thank Billy again for asking me to come here. Thank Bob again and Kelly for their great company. And if there's anything that you've heard that you've liked, well, it's on God. If there's anything you heard that you didn't like, it's on me because God doesn't make mistakes. Thank you.